God's people are to offer the world an alternative set of values. We're to offer the world a different set of behaviors. One way in which God's people are not asked to be different is with regard to families. Every culture has ways of structuring families, and God's people, whether Jews or Christians, are no different. We embrace marriage as a covenant. It's not to be taken lightly. It's important for us to talk about the meaning of marriage as we ponder whether same-sex marriage can be godly or not. I want very much to make it through all of these comments. And so my final comments, I don't think will take my whole 5 minutes, and so I will respond to Patrick then. But I want very much to get through these comments as best I can. So, as I said in my opening remarks, many countries around the world and several states here in the U.S. have begun to expand the definition of marriage to include same-sex couples. It's right for Christians to think and pray about this so they know if it's a way of the world they should resist, if they should not be conformed to the world, or if it is something they can embrace as morally appropriate. The Bible only knows one kind of marriage between a man and a woman. The biblical authors almost all understood marriage as a contract involving the exchange of the bride from the possession of her father to the possession of her husband. Deuteronomy 5:21, among others, says, "Neither shall you covet your neighbor's wife, nor your neighbor's house, or field, or male or female slave, or ox, or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor." For whatever genuine affection there might have been between fathers and daughters, and husbands and wives, women were legally property, along with the house, the farm, the donkey, and everything else. To commit adultery was to treat a woman as if she was yours, rather than another man's property. It wasn't about avoiding emotional damage. It wasn't even about honoring the marriage contract. It was about the fact that knowing her intimately was stealing the use of a body which was the possession of someone else. We see lingering traces of this notion in the traditional wedding ceremonies when the officiant asks, "Who gives this woman to be married to this man?" And in the language of abusive relationships where one partner says, "If I can't have you, no one else will." The biblical texts about marriage assume that the woman will become her husband's legal property and responsibility, just as the Bible assumes that slavery is a fact of life as well. Surely this sense of being able to possess another human being is something we must reject. But it's not the heart of what marriage is about, and so we do not reject marriage. That marriage is between a man and a woman is assumed, but it's not the heart of marriage, and so gay and lesbian folks do not reject marriage. That some rich and powerful men might take any number of concubines, not marriage partners, but women who are their sole sexual property nonetheless, is also assumed in the biblical texts, but we reject it as well. At least most Americans do. In a few American subcultures, sister wives happily share the affections of one husband. In other cultures around the world, men may legally have more than one wife. Still, it is the same patriarchal pattern of one man at the powerful center of a family of wives and children who are satellites around him and possessions of his, and that is not the heart of marriage, and so we do not reject these images either. Well, no, we reject the images, but we don't reject the notion of marriage. Despite the patriarchal cultures in which the biblical texts were written and the patriarchal practices which so often structured the families in biblical times, we see glimpses in the biblical texts about what the real heart of marriage is, and that's what I want to explore. Beginning with Genesis 1, God says, let us make humankind in our image according to our likeness, and without saying how, it is done. The text simply says God created them, male and female, blessed them, and asked them to care for the rest of creation. In the other creation story in Genesis 2, God has finished most of creation and has created the first human being and is looking for a proper companion because it's not right for this person to be alone. God says, I will make a helper to be a partner. And God begins to create all manner of other creatures, none of whom are right for this fellow. And so God puts the human being to sleep, takes a rib, creates another human being, and when the first person known to most of us as Adam wakes up and sees the second person, he doesn't say, holy smoke, God, you made me someone curvy where I'm not curvy. You didn't make me someone with whom I will fit sexually. Adam says, here at last is someone like me. It's the similarities between Adam and Eve that strike Adam the most. The story also says that somehow Adam knows this other person, this woman, is created from something taken out of him, and it is for that reason that a man takes a wife and clings to her, because she completes him. I dare say that marriage really isn't about somehow bringing the missing piece back to every man. Both creation stories imply that the purpose of human pairings is for help, for companionship, for intimacy, and for sharing a life of caring for and being upheld by each other. If that's what's at the heart of marriage, then I believe the desire for same-sex couples to be allowed to marry is, in fact, consistent with biblical teaching. I will admit to have consulted some other books and websites in preparation for this debate, and I guess I didn't need to worry about that because obviously Patrick has as well. And on the website Christianity.about.com, I found a compelling article called What Does the Bible Say About Marriage? By Mary Fairchild. She wasn't talking about gay marriage, just marriage. And I offer this quote. She says, in his book, Sacred Marriage, Gary Thomas asks this question, what if God designed marriage to make us holy more than to make us happy? Is it possible that there is something much more profound in the heart of God than simply to make us happy? Can we lay down our own ambitions in order to love and serve our spouse? Through marriage, we can learn about unconditional love, respectful honor, how to forgive and be forgiven. We can see our shortcomings and grow from that insight. We can develop a servant's heart and draw closer to God. As a result, true soul happiness can be discovered, and this, I believe, is one of God's ultimate desires and purposes for designing the covenant of marriage, end quote. This author starts out by saying that maybe the purpose for marriage is to make us holy, not happy. And yet he ends up by saying that when we become holy, we find real happiness. Can anybody say amen to that tonight?
Amen.
Thank you. When people strive to be happy, they will meet up with all manner of temptations that draw them toward temporary, selfish happiness and away from their right relationship with God and probably away from their right relationship with self and others as well. One of my favorite verses from Psalm 37 says, trust in the Lord and do good, so you will live in the land and enjoy security. Take delight in the Lord, and God will give you the desires of your heart. This is not to be understood as a vending machine type transaction where any of us sets our sight on a certain delight, then pays God the right number of good works or hours of prayer or pages of Bible study in order to receive the thing we've set our sights on. When anyone puts God first and develops that relationship with integrity and humility, God will bless them. I know a lesbian couple who has a simple creed for their life together. God first, me and my family second, everything else after that. Amen. If part of the purpose for marriage is to help make a person more holy, then I believe same-sex marriage is consistent with that teaching. Paul talks a lot about marriage. In fact, there's an infamous comment where Paul says that he believes that people should only marry if their sexual appetites can't be held in control. He says, not everyone, like me, has the spiritual gift of celibacy, and so it is better for you to marry than to be inflamed by your passions. Let's stop here for just a second. If the only legal marriage option in Paul's day was between a man and a woman, he assumes that pairing, but look at what he says. It's better to be married than to be aflame with passion. By denying the chance for gay men and lesbians to marry, the church puts them in a permanent state of being aflame with passions that challenge their self-control on a regular basis. Not everyone has the gift of celibacy. Paul acknowledges that. And for the church in our day to insist that gay men and lesbians remain celibate is to force them to behave in a way that may be contrary to their spiritual gifts and opens them to temptation which they may or may not be able to resist. The rest of this will not fit in 2 minutes. So, I guess I will say a common judgment of gay men and lesbians is that they are promiscuous, that they have uncontrolled passions, that sex is their defining characteristic. And it seems to me that if the church is interested in helping gay people, it truly would allow them to marry, even encourage them to marry, so that they would have legitimately recognized relationships in which to have their needs met, so that they could get on with the business of doing God's work in the world. If, as Paul says, the end is near, and that we should dedicate our lives to doing good works, then homosexual marriage is consistent with that teaching. If it's better to be married than to sin, then the church should stop accusing gay men and lesbians of being unrepentant sinners and allow them to enter into covenantal relationships that give them a way to live without sin.